The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I was away last week teaching a retreat with Gil at IRC. And the theme that we explored during the week was this theme that I brought into the guided meditation, that of this definition, essentially, of wise mindfulness in the suttas. Abide, one abides, observing. The body is a body, essentially experience as experience. And the rest of the phrase is ardent, mindful, fully aware, setting aside covetousness and grief for the world. And in some ways, this sentence is really a kind of an encapsulation of our practice. And so I wanted to explore this phrase with you today. But to start, I want to start with the word mindful that's in the middle of the phrase rather than with the other words that are around it. Mindfulness is a pretty ordinary phenomenon in our experience. It's something that's very natural as human beings to have this capacity to be aware. And the word mindfulness often evokes other words such as being present, knowing what's happening while it's happening, being aware, witnessing, observing, knowing, that kind of experience, connecting with experience, being with experience. And yet there's this recognition of it being almost a self-reflective kind of awareness. So it's not just being, being with experience, because sometimes we can be with experience and kind of be lost in it. And so it's this being aware, knowing that we are aware, that this quality of mindfulness points to. And again, it's a natural quality, and in some ways it's a quality that, in some ways I think it's one of those special qualities about being human. There are not too many animals that have this self-reflective capacity. Apparently there are some. I think they say that dolphins have this capacity, and they test this by whether animals recognize that a reflection in a mirror is themselves or not. And so, cats, basically, you put a cat in front of a mirror and it kind of tries to attack or go behind the mirror to find the other animal or run away or arch and hiss. And so that is not a self-reflective awareness, not aware that the movement that you're doing is reflected by the movement in the mirror. Apparently, gorillas have this capacity. So, for instance, if they put a gorilla in front of a mirror and they have something on their face or something, the gorilla understands that that's a reflection of them, and they might touch their face to see what that thing is. And so this capacity to be self-reflective, this is what mindfulness points to. This capacity to know our own being as a being. And it's a natural capacity. It's a neutral capacity. And yet the Buddha kind of highlighted it and said, this is a useful capacity of mind when it's connected with a particular perspective, when we are interested in exploring this capacity of being mindful, of being present, aware in the present moment, with a particular curiosity about experience in a certain way. And I think that's what this phrase encapsulates, is this perspective of mindfulness that's useful for freedom from suffering. This is the quest, the kind of perspective the Buddha, or the question the Buddha was interested in when he started his own journey, is it possible to be free from distress, sorrow, grief, despair. Not is it possible to be free from unpleasant experience, but is it possible to be free from a mind that is reactive to what is happening? And he highlighted this quality of mindfulness as being central in the understanding of our experience that helps to free us, that helps to free the mind from this kind of reactivity, this reactivity about what is happening in the present moment. This idea of constructing a future or holding on to the past and suffering, reacting to those thoughts and ideas and views and opinions. And so he pointed to mindfulness as a key and encouraged us in this one text that this phrase comes from to cultivate and establish this quality of mindfulness, but to establish it in a particular way. And so I want to just point to, first of all, how this ordinary quality is not always used in this specific way. So, this capacity of being aware can be associated with different intentions, I would say. You know, different motivations for why we want to be aware. Might be that there's some wholesome reasons, some skillful reasons for that, some unwholesome reasons. So, you know, perhaps a surgeon wants to be very present and aware for what they're doing. That is a kind of an occupation where that it really can cultivate that presence of mind to know exactly what you're doing in any given moment. The motivation behind that might be wanting to heal, which is a wholesome motivation. The motivation behind that might maybe be connected a little bit to wanting to heal, but also connected to wanting to be known as a really good surgeon so that you get more referrals and can get more money. And so that there can be different motivations for even the same activity. And then, you know, kind of one of the classic examples of how mindfulness can be misapplied, and or applied in an unwholesome way, I guess we could say, is that of a thief in a house. You know, wandering through the house to steal things. They may be very aware, moment to moment, of what they're doing, how much sound they're making. And very quietly picking up things and to not wake up the occupants of the house. And yet the motivation behind this awareness is greed rather than a kind of a interest or curiosity in how we might be able to be free from suffering. And so this the perspective that the Buddha encourages us to hold our mindfulness with is crucial in our spiritual journey, in our meditation practice, and in our spiritual journey. And so what I think this phrase represents is essentially the kind of a key definition of what wise mindfulness is, this factor of the Eightfold Path, wise mindfulness. And so I just want to kind of go through each of these aspects of this phrase today. At the retreat when Gil and I did this, we took three talks to go through this phrase. So there can be a lot of depth in the exploration, and I'm just going to kind of skim the surface today, but just to give you a flavor of the kind of the big picture of what the Buddha encouraged us in terms of how, both how and what, to pay attention to. So the first word in this phrase is abide. And I mentioned that in the meditation. The word abide, I think, even evokes. When I say it to myself, there's almost just this settling. Abide. It's got an evocative quality to it of settling in, of relaxing, of opening to being with in a relaxed way. And so it kind of, it evokes that sense of relaxing, and also to me of receiving. When we abide, we're not you know, going out and trying to figure things out. It's much more we're settled back, you know. I have this image of, at one point, a friend and I were talking about this quality of mindfulness, and he said, yeah, I like to think of myself on a beach on an easy chair with my floppy hat on and my sunglasses on. I'm just kind of settled back and just kind of letting the world go by and, the you know, just like come to me. I'm not out there trying to figure out what people are doing or what's going on. I'm just abiding, you know, settling back. So that image of resting back and just taking what's coming, that is kind of to me what is evoked with this word. Abide, relax, and receive experience. Relax and receive. Abide. A couple of times when I've talked about this word, people have reminded me, and somebody did this on the retreat too. One of the retreatants came into a meeting, and the first thing they said was, the dude abides, which is a phrase from I think it's the Big Lebowski, a movie, and it's, you know, it's kind of this I have this image of this really kind of laid-back, hippie kind of person, and he's like, yeah, and he calls himself the dude, and it's like, oh, the dude abides. So that can bring a little bit of lightness to the image as well. The dude abides. The dudess abides. The next word is observes. And so this brings in kind of another aspect, that it's not just like settle back and not be aware of what's happening. In fact, with mindfulness, there is this kind of interest in what's happening while it's happening. And so it's not a spacing out abide. It's a very present abide. Observing, being with what's here, connected to what's happening. And that word observing is connected to the phrase, and this phrase changes based on the four different perspectives or four different establishments of mindfulness that are talked about in the sutta. One abides observing the body as a body. One abides observing feelings as feelings. One abides observing mind states as mind states. One abides observing essentially phenomena as phenomena. And so this is bringing in not only in a way what we are observing, but how we are observing it. So the four foundations or the four establishments of mindfulness essentially encompass the entirety of our experience. Nothing is left out of what we open to with this observing quality. Nothing is left out. And yet there's an encouragement, and this is key. I think this is one of the key aspects of how mindfulness becomes wise mindfulness. There's an encouragement to notice what's happening in the present moment as something happening in the present moment. And that sounds like, why would that be helpful sometimes? It just sounds like it's just saying the same thing. But this perspective is quite a radical shift in our interest for being aware of what's happening in the present moment. Because typically, when we become aware, when we are aware of something happening in the present moment, there's a strong habit of mind to be more interested in how is this going to help me get what I want or get rid of what I don't want. So it's kind of oriented towards greed and aversion. Often when we become aware of what's happening in the present moment, it's, oh, this is happening. Oh, how can I use this to make myself more productive or more have more pleasant things, or to fix this thing, or to control that thing, or manipulate this, or to get what I want from this person. And so often we are not simply, when we become aware of body, feeling, mind states, phenomena, there's an agenda that goes along with it. That's not simply, oh, this is an experience of body happening right now. This is a feeling. This pleasant experience is a pleasant experience happening right now. Typically we would, oh, this is a pleasant experience. Oh, how can I keep this? So we might become aware of a pleasant experience, and then our habits and patterns kind of come into the service of doing something with that pleasant experience, aside from simply recognizing it. And I will point out that even in this practice, even in this exploration, there's an encouragement to recognize, yes, this is a pleasant experience arising in the present moment. And to recognize whether there's habitual reactivity of greed or aversion around the experience. Pleasant experience tends to be greed. Unpleasant experience tends to be aversion. And yet when we begin to recognize, oh, this is a pleasant experience, or this is an unpleasant experience, this is happening right now, there's like a little bit of an opportunity for our minds to recognize that habitual movement and perhaps choose a different response. So this opening to experience as experience in the present moment creates a little bit of space for perhaps wisdom to come in and inform a different relationship to what is happening. And so this piece of the teaching, this aspect of the teaching of mindfulness is often misunderstood as being, we don't do anything. We just notice experience as experience. It means that we just sit like a lump and just kind of let things happen to us. There's a piece of that opening to experience happening in the present moment as what's happening in the present moment. Essentially, you know, what has come into being. What has come being into being, what we are experiencing in this moment, what we are already experiencing in this moment, whether pleasant or unpleasant, whether body sensation, vibration, tingling, pulsing, burning, whether some mood or mind state, whatever is here being observed in this moment is already here. And that is an encouragement to know this is here. It's already here. In the moment of noticing something is here, there's a kind of the next step is what, how our system chooses to engage with that experience to move us into the next moment. We are active beings. Our system is designed to respond. And yet habitually we tend to respond with greed and aversion and confusion. And so what this mindfulness does, this aspect of mindfulness, this mindfulness with a particular perspective, begins to open us to recognize, oh, this is happening. And what might be a skillful response to this? And what seems to happen over time is that the more our system begins to recognize the greed and the aversion responses, and I'll talk about this a little bit more in a bit, the more our system recognizes that those responses in the moment contribute to tension and not well-being. And so our system begins to release those and begins to orient to a different response to the world. And this can be hard to trust initially, because greed and aversion and confusion have so motivated us for so long that we sometimes buy into the belief that they are connected to. You know, if I didn't act out of greed and aversion, I wouldn't do anything. You know, it's like sometimes we have that kind of belief. And yet, when greed and aversion start to release their grip on our hearts, we discover that there are motivating forces in our hearts that inspire us to act, that are beautiful forces. The force of love, the force of compassion, the force of wisdom, generosity. These are active forces also. And so the exploring this presence with being available to notice what's happening as it's happening creates a space for those forces to become the motivators of how we respond to experience. And this is not something that happens immediately. You know, it's not like we turn our attention to the present moment and suddenly we're motivated by love and compassion and wisdom. Often what we get to see is the greed and aversion. And so that also becomes in the foundation of mind states. One abides observing mind states as mind states. And in that particular foundation, the encouragement is, well, when one notices greed arising in the mind, one knows greed is arising in the mind. When aversion is arising in the mind, one knows aversion is arising in the mind. And so right there, oh, there's pleasant experience and wanting is happening. Then we're in that foundation, of that exploration of knowing the mind in relationship, that greed has arisen. That too is something to know. This moment, that has arisen. Can that be known? The knowing of greed, the knowing of aversion, completely different. It's a vast difference between being aware, wow, aversion is arising in this moment, and buying into aversion and acting on it. Acting out of that aversion. And so this is a part of our exploration of this piece of the instruction as well. Whatever is arising, no part left out of our experience. The entirety of our experience observed. Oh, this is what's arising right now. And so this combination of abides observing, to me, brings in both a relaxed and yet alert kind of quality to it. It's pointing to that we're not just kind of checked out. We are knowing what's happening in the present moment. And the next word in the phrase ardent kind of also points to this. Ardent being a word that points to a kind of a connectedness to experience, or a keeping experience in mind. The word in English that's used, ardent, in this case, also connotes a kind of a heart connection to the experience, that there's a kind of an emotional sense of the value or something of being with experience, so that there's a heartfelt engagement and interest. Interest, too, I think, is a piece potentially of this particular word. When there's interest, there's a connection. There's this kind of sense of, yeah, this is useful. This is interesting. So ardent, this word, kind of evokes some of those flavors. It also evokes a kind of a gentle, a kind of a persistent quality to our attention, which begins to point to, in this establishing of mindfulness, this importance of continuity of this quality of mindfulness. Actually, the power of the this quality of mindfulness, being aware of what's happening in the present moment while it's happening, the power of that is established with the continuity of mindfulness, moment to moment, knowing this is what's happening in the present moment, this is what's happening in the present moment. That begins to reveal many things, not just this is what's happening in the present moment, but the relationship moment to moment of what's happening. It begins to point out that this moment conditions the next moment, and this moment that's arising was conditioned by the past. And so we begin to see how our minds function. We begin to recognize that there's a kind of an impermanent quality to experience. That seeing, oh, this is what's arising right now, this is what's arising right now, this is what's arising right now, there begins to be this recognition, wow, it's never the same, any two moments. The more continuous the mindfulness gets, the more the impermanent or inconstant changing nature of experience is revealed. And that supports the mind to begin to recognize, wow, trying to hold on to something, to the whole movement of greed is, you know, God, maybe I can hold on to this and keep it, keep my life oriented and hold this into place so that I'll be happy for a long time. Or maybe some of us oriented more around aversion, maybe I can keep this unpleasant thing at bay, control my experience and my environment so that I don't have to be associated with that unpleasant thing. And so the mind that begins to recognize the impermanent nature of experience begins to see that activity of trying to keep things solid and stable is destined to fail, destined to fall apart, collapse, and that the holding on, the trying to cling, to keep things to be a certain way, will create suffering. Somebody at one point, this analogy has been in this particular Western tradition, Western Vipassana tradition, for a number of years. I think it was a yogi on one retreat described in their experience this act of clinging to things that are just changing and falling away as being like rope burn. You know, if you're trying to hold on to a rope as it's slipping through your hand is going to get torn up. And that's basically the kind of thing that happens, because things are changing. The rope is slipping through. And if we're trying to hold on to it, suffering will be created. And so this is kind of begins to be revealed by this ardency, this continuity of attention, this impermanent nature of experience, this conditioned nature of experience. And it begins to help us to realize that our habitual patterns around greed and aversion are not actually serving us. And so our minds begin to reorient and kind of ask the question, maybe there's another way. And our minds begin to find other qualities, as I pointed to. Our minds begin to find that love and compassion are different relationships to experience, wisdom, balance of mind, different relationships to experience that create a whole different quality in the mind, a whole different relationship to not only our own experience, but to our friends, our families, what's happening in the world. And it doesn't create, in my experience at least, it doesn't create a passive relationship to the world. It creates a very informed and kind of dynamic relationship to the world, but one where the heart is not contracted and closed, but where the heart is open and responsive. I used this analogy at the retreat about when we're motivated by greed and aversion, it's like we have shackles on our heart. It's like, you know, there's armor around our heart, and it's tight, it's constricted. And often we can actually feel that when we notice greed arising in the present moment, aversion arising in the present moment. We feel that armor. We feel the hardness there. And we feel also at times that we feel disconnected from the world, feel disconnected from friends, family. Maybe feels like we're protecting ourselves, but we're doing it with such rigidity. And so there's a way that that hardness keeps us separated from the world. And as greed and aversion start to release and fall away, there's kind of my experience is more that the heart begins to feel like jello. You know, it's something that vibrates. It's a resonant kind of experience and feeling that as you know, suffering comes in, as joy comes in, the heart resonates in empathy with that. And it's not like that; those experiences aren't bouncing off the heart. And so compassion is a result of this soft heart, this jello-like heart. When the heart meets suffering in the world, it resonates in response, and there's this movement of wanting to act to alleviate that suffering. When this heart that's open meets joy in the world, it resonates in empathy and sympathy with that and delights in wholesome joy in the world, delights when others have success in the world, have success in their lives and appreciation in their lives. And so the hard heart may tend to be separate when there's suffering in the world, and it may be more like, well, thank goodness it's not me, or, they must have deserved that, or And there's not that empathetic resonance. Or, you know, sometimes when there's somebody, one of our friends or family, or we see somebody else experiencing success, there can be a hardness there too. It's like, why not me? What about me? It means less for me. And so the experiences of connectedness in the world bounce off of the heart that's kind of enshackled with greed and aversion. And yet the heart, when it begins to release that, which it does as we begin to feel that hardness, as we begin to recognize, oh, greed feels like this, hard, tight, constricted. Aversion feels like this, burning, pressure. That turning, knowing greed is arising in the present moment, as greed is arising in the present moment, creates the conditions for our system to begin to find a new way. And it tends to find its way towards love and compassion and wisdom. So this is this kind of connectedness, this ardency, this connecting to experience, this persistent kind of being with experience creates conditions for us to open to these truths, impermanent, conditioned nature of experience, which helps the mind to let go of its habitual reactions to the world. And yet the way we do this, this ardency can be a kind of an activity of mind. How do we connect? How do we encourage connection with experience? And this is a place, I think, often where our mindfulness begins to get tight, where we can kind of bring a quality of greed to the practice itself. We want to stay present, and we try to hold on to mindfulness, just like we try to hold on to some pleasant experience. We might sit down at the beginning of a meditation period and think, oh, I need to stay present for this whole meditation period. It's almost like we're trying to pick up the whole 30 minutes, 40 minutes of practice at the beginning in that very first moment and stay present for it for the entire time, kind of picking up the amount of energy we think we need to be present for a long time. And our system doesn't quite work that way. We can kind of pick up enough energy to be present for a half a breath. Right now, can you know an in-breath? Can you know an out-breath? Just that. Can you know the sensations of your hands touching or your hands, wherever they are. Can you know the sensations of your hands right now? How hard is this? It doesn't actually take that much effort to connect for a moment. And so this is the art of ardency, really, is exploring just enough effort to be present for this moment and then doing it again. It doesn't take a lot to do it for a moment. We just have to keep remembering to do it. Keep remembering moment after moment to stay connected. And that takes a little bit of effort to remember. We can kind of prompt ourselves a little bit, you know, just enough to be with an in-breath. Okay, now enough for an out-breath. And the end of the out-breath, oh, just enough for an in-breath. Just remembering. Just enough. Doing walking meditation, I practice this with kind of noticing, oh, there's a little spot on the ground 2 feet out. Can I be present until I get to that spot? That's not so hard. I can do that. And then I pick another spot. So that kind of remembering to pick the next spot, that's also a little bit of effort, but it's way less effort than thinking, I have to stay present for the entire 40 minutes of walking practice. It's just enough. Oh, can I get to that leaf? Can I get to that crack in the sidewalk? Can I get to that tree? Just enough effort. And this takes a kind of, it's like of a dance, a little bit of a dance of practicing to encourage this kind of light touch to the effort that we make. The next phrase is fully aware. Fully aware. And this phrase is used in a couple of different places in the text. In one place, it's pointing to being fully aware in all of our activities. So again, pointing to this kind of, we explore this continuity of mindfulness. This one section says that we act in full awareness, like one acts in full awareness while walking, while standing, while going to and coming away from, while extending and bending one's limbs, while urinating and defecating. Even that's in the sutta. While eating, while speaking, while remaining silent, one acts in full awareness. So pointing to this kind of the continuity of awareness again. But also in other places it's pointing to, again, this recognition of impermanence. In some places this word fully aware is defined as being fully aware of experience as it arises, it persists, and changes. As it arises, as it persists, and ends. And so the extending arises, persists, and then it's over. At some point we bend. Also feelings, thoughts, they arise, they last for a while, they end. And so again, recognizing, this is a piece of recognizing experience in the present moment, that we begin to recognize that the changing nature of experience. And so here, this is a direct pointing in this definition of mindfulness to include knowing change is happening. It's not just what's happening in the present moment. It's not just there's body sensation and then feeling and then sight and sound. It's, oh, there's a sight. And then the mind shifts to something else, seeing the shift of attention. Or maybe there's the awareness of something arising and actually the attention stays with it for long enough to see it linger and pass away. That kind of recognition, that kind of full awareness becomes very powerful for us as we begin to more deeply recognize just how impermanent experience is. And so this is another pointing in the actual definition. We not only know what's here, that it's happening in the present moment, but we kind of attune to this quality of change, changing experience. The last piece of the phrase is setting aside desires and discontent for the world. And this is kind of interesting because some commentary have said this means that the establishment of mindfulness, in order to practice this kind of establishment of mindfulness, hindrances can no longer be arising. We are free. It's so that some translators say it's like we are free from desires and discontent for the world. And yet there's other places in the pointing to the what we notice, like in the foundation of the mindfulness of mind states, it points to knowing aversion as it's arising in the moment. It points to knowing a greed as it's arising in the moment. And so how to kind of navigate, or how to understand this framing of what does this mean to include freeing or setting aside. I like this translation, setting aside greed and or covetousness and grief for the world. Because as Bhikkhu Anālayo points out, this kind of active word, this is actually the form of the verb that's used in the Pali. It's an active word. It's not past tense. It is while we're doing this, it's kind of more like what's happening is that we are freeing ourselves from desire and discontent. So it's part of the process of how this works. Seeing experience arising is experience arising in the moment. Knowing greed as it's arising, seeing the impermanence of mind states, body experiences, begins to free the mind. So it's a process that happens simultaneously with this practice. The mind frees itself from covetousness and grief for the world. So that's one way to look at this, this phrase, is that it's almost more the natural result of this first part of the definition. That as we abide, observing experience as experience, ardent and clearly comprehending change, the result of that is that the mind begins to let go of greed, aversion, and confusion. So that's one way to look at this. Gil pointed out another way during this retreat to look at this phrase, which I thought was really interesting. He pointed to the phrase, the piece of the phrase that one sets aside or puts aside covetousness and grief for the world. And so he pointed out that could be understood. And I asked him afterwards if there's any evidence in the sutta for the use of the word in the world to mean this. And he says, well, this is clearly an interpretation. This is my interpretation. But there are places in the sutta. So there's different ways the word for world is used in the suttas. In some places it means the world of our physical experience, the inner landscape of experience. And sometimes it means more the external world. And so he was choosing to believe in this moment that the Buddha used the word setting aside covetousness and grief for the world to mean setting aside kind of this movement of greed and aversion towards things that are outside of us. So that the kind of the use of the world is external. It's not clear in the sutta what this use of the word the world means, but I really liked this kind of framing of it because what this points to, this kind of interpretation of that the operative word here is in the world, is that most of our greed and aversion, much of our greed and aversion as it's arising, is related to the external world. It's related to wanting to have something, maybe something material, so something outside in the world. I want that thing. I want to get rid of that thing. So we're kind of oriented through the habit of greed and aversion to orient towards the external world and be trying to manipulate the external world. Or it might be that we want somebody to see us in a certain way. So kind of, you know, wanting particular approval or wanting somebody to love us or wanting to people to have a particular opinion of us. So again, orienting towards the external world, desire, covetousness for particular reinforcement or for having certain lovely things associated with us. And so those movements of greed and aversion tend to be oriented outwards. The delusion of greed and aversion is, if I can control the world out there, I'll be happy. And if we explore the possibility of setting aside the orientation towards the external around covetousness and grief, greed and aversion, and instead explore, oh, greed or aversion, covetousness and grief are arising here. It's turning away from the external and towards the internal. And so again, it's very much that, almost a reinforcement of knowing feelings as feelings. No part left out, just, oh, greed is arising in the present moment. And so it's a kind of conscious recognition of the habit of covetousness and grief to kind of attach to the world and remember, oh, here, now, what's this, here and now? What's this experience in the moment? And so one abides, observing the body as a body, feelings as feelings, emotions as emotions, phenomena as phenomena, ardent, fully aware, setting aside covetousness and grief for the world. And this creates the conditions, this kind of mindfulness. It's so powerful. I really do have the sense that once we kind of get the capacity of the mind to land and the establishment of this quality of mindfulness in this way, it can become established in the sense that it's not something we're having to do so much. You know, the active part of ardency, where we have to remember, next moment, next moment, next moment. As mindfulness gets established, there's less of that need. And there's more just this quality present available to know this is what's arising in this moment. And the heart is more available to respond in a skillful way. And this establishment of mindfulness, we begin to trust that that will serve us. That is enough for freedom, for the mind to begin to reorient in this way, as I described. It begins to understand greed and aversion don't serve us and begin to kind of find their way, our system inherently. It's a great thing about our system. It essentially wants to be happy. It wants to have well-being. It wants to move towards ease and peace. And yet it fundamentally has gotten so confused about how to do that. And our ideas, our views, our beliefs, our opinions, our agendas are kind of operating in between this kind of natural movement towards well-being and our actions. And so that movement towards well-being gets co-opted by our agendas and beliefs and does things that don't actually serve us, that actually reinforce this hardness and shackling of the heart. And yet as we start to see, as the mindfulness is established and we start to see the way that those patterns are not well-being, so our mind begins to get a different education about what's useful. We have believed that our agendas around get rid of, control, fix, manipulate, that's how we'll be happy. And yet, what we start to see as mindfulness gets established is that natural movement towards well-being begins to kind of, it feels to me like it pulls us from underneath. It's like that deep inner movement towards well-being becomes more active and begins to draw us in the direction of letting go of greed, aversion, and delusion. and draws us in the direction of love and compassion and wisdom. And it's not something that we have to do so much. We explore the opening to this capacity for mindfulness, and then we begin to trust that that moves us in the direction of freedom and releasing of those shacklings of our heart. So we have a few minutes for comments or questions or anything that you'd like to share. It could be anything at all. Yeah, and let's use the mic.
I was on the retreat, and this was a wonderful return and summary and reprocessing. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious about the translation of the last piece and
the freeing oneself from.
Yeah, sometimes it's aversion and sometimes it's grief, and those are, in my intellect, cognitive yeah. self, very different, and I don't know how to. Or even if it's an important question.
Well, it might be. It might well be an important question. I mean, it might also point to particular aspects. The words are not what are typically translated as greed and aversion. They are more specific. And they are more translated as covetousness, really desiring things, material things in the world. Is what that word seems to mean. And grief, again, in relationship to loss of things in the world. That seems to be more what the quality or meaning of those words is, which is part of why Gil felt like the use of for the world was a useful where the world is external, because those two words are more associated with the craving and aversion for external stuff. And greed and aversion can be applied to subtle, very subtle things, not external things. We can have greed for states of concentration, and we can have aversion around particular we might have aversion around having done something unskillful. Where that aversion is kind of joined up with a wholesome quality of regret, but is kind of sticky. And so, so greed and aversion can be more internally applied. So I understand greed as aversion as being broader than covetousness and grief. So it may also be that sentence is pointing to, well, there's a certain kind of really big craving and aversion that we need to let go of in order to engage in this practice. Certain kind of major cravings that support to be able to, maybe even just consciously say, yeah, I'm just going to set that aside right now. And that's another way of that, translating that first part. Just set it aside. Just like let it go for now and orient towards this internal experience. So it may be an important part of it, but my understanding that those words are narrower words than greed and aversion themselves. Yeah. Yeah.
Loss, and especially as it relates to love, mm-hmm. I don't think of as a hindrance.
Loss is not a hindrance. And the emotion of that, the emotion of loss, I would say, is something like sadness. Loss is a natural, loss is a happening. there is impermanence. Things vanish. And there can be the experience of loss there. And in my own experience, there's a difference, I'd say, a difference between when the heart takes in loss and can resonate with that jello-like quality versus when the heart says no to loss. And to me, the grief is more that sticky quality. And the that's how I use the word grief. For other people, it's not necessarily that way. But for me, sadness is more the kind of the heart that's able to kind of allow the loss to pour through. It's just resonating in the system as a recognition, yeah, there's loss. And it's another way sometimes Gil describes the stickiness is it's like there's Velcro in the heart. And so with grief around loss, it feels like there's a tearing or a pulling. It's not that the heart is able to just let it pour through. And I've experienced, there's times where I've experienced sadness that it feels really pure. It doesn't feel like there's any tearing in the heart. It's just an acknowledgement of loss. And so to me, that is possible. Yeah. And it's time to stop. So thank you for your attention.